A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about forward scouting, the Secret Service's advance operation, the part of personal protection that happens before the protectee ever leaves the White House. He's asking what a typical advance team is searching for when they survey an area, and how far ahead they actually travel to do it. And honestly, this is one of those functions where the gap between what people imagine and what's actually happening is enormous.
It really is. Most people picture the guys in sunglasses and earpieces standing around the president, and that's the whole job. But the protective bubble is the last layer, not the first. The advance team is what makes that bubble possible at all. They're the architects of the entire security envelope. Without them, the shift agents on the ground are basically improvising.
Which is the nightmare scenario. Improvising presidential security. I mean, think about what that actually looks like. An agent walking into a hotel ballroom for the first time at the same moment the president does. He's scanning windows, checking doors, watching hands in the crowd, all simultaneously, with no prior knowledge of the floor plan. That's not security. That's hoping really hard.
Hope is not a methodology. It's why the service drills this distinction so aggressively in training. The shift agent on the body is reactive by design. They respond to threats as they emerge. The advance agent is proactive. They eliminate threats before they can emerge. Two completely different operational mindsets, and the service selects for them differently. Advance agents tend to be more methodical, more systems-oriented. They're the ones who enjoy building the spreadsheet as much as kicking down the door.
Let's define what we're talking about. The advance team is a specialized subgroup within the Secret Service's Protective Operations Division. They deploy ahead of any protectee movement, and I mean any movement. A trip to Camp David, a visit to Walter Reed, a campaign rally in Ohio. Every single one has a corresponding advance. These are not the agents you see on television. They're a different breed entirely.
They're the ones who've already been in the hotel ballroom days before anyone else gets there, checking whether the chandelier can support a sniper's weight or whether the HVIC intake is accessible from a public hallway. And, I should clarify, when I say checking whether the chandelier can support a sniper's weight, I don't mean they're wondering if a counter-sniper could set up there. I mean they're asking whether an adversary could. They're thinking like the attacker, not like the defender. That's the fundamental mental shift.
Invert the problem. Don't ask, how do I protect this room? Ask, if I wanted to hurt someone in this room, how would I do it? And then close every one of those doors.
That's the job. And the Protective Operations Division overall has about 1,300 agents assigned to protective details. Of those, roughly 200 are dedicated to advance work at any given time. It's a substantial operation. For a typical domestic presidential trip, you're looking at an advance team of 15 to 25 agents, plus support from the counter-assault team and the technical security division. For a foreign trip, those numbers go way up. A G20 summit can involve over 100 advance personnel, and they may be on the ground for weeks before the principal arrives.
Let's talk timeline, because that's the first thing Daniel asked about. How far ahead are we talking?
It depends on the trip. For routine domestic movements, the president speaking at a convention center in Chicago, say, the advance team deploys 48 to 72 hours ahead. For a major domestic trip with multiple stops, it's more like 7 to 14 days. And for foreign travel, the advance can begin 30 days out. The Secret Service conducted over 8,000 protective advances in fiscal year 2025 alone, covering everything from presidential travel to foreign dignitary visits and major candidate protection during the campaign cycle.
8,000 advances in a year. That's more than 20 a day on average. And that number staggers me every time I hear it, because each advance isn't a phone call. It's not a quick check-in with the local field office. It's a full deployment. Multiple agents traveling to a location, spending days on site, generating reports, coordinating with locals, and then doing it all over again somewhere else 3 days later. The operational tempo is relentless.
It's a machine, and the site survey is where it starts. The advance team conducts what they call a walkthrough of every single location the Protectee will visit. Hotels, event venues, motorcade routes, hospitals, even bathrooms. Nothing is too small. If the Protectee might spend 15 minutes in a room, that room gets the full treatment. I want to emphasize the bathroom point because it sounds trivial, but it's not. Restrooms are uncontrolled spaces with multiple entry and exit points, often with service access for maintenance, and people let their guard down in them. An advance agent will clear every stall, check every ceiling panel, and then post someone to control access for the duration of the visit.
What's the full treatment look like for a room the president is actually going to occupy?
They're looking at four main categories. First, line-of-sight vulnerabilities. Any window, rooftop, or elevated position with a clear view of where the Protectee will be standing, walking, or entering a vehicle. They map every angle. They identify which windows can be opened, which rooftops have access ladders, which parking garages overlook the motorcade route. And here's the thing, they're not just noting these, they're assigning a countermeasure to each one. That window with the clear sight line? It's either getting closed and locked, posted with a counter sniper, or the Protectee's path is being adjusted to avoid the exposure. There's no, we'll keep an eye on it. Every vulnerability gets a response.
It's not a survey. It's a survey with an attached action plan.
Second, structural weaknesses, unsecured basement access, service tunnels, loading docks that aren't properly controlled, elevator shafts that connect to unsecured floors. I once heard about an advance at a major convention center where the team discovered a service elevator that went from the underground parking garage directly to the green room with no access control on either end. The venue staff had been using it to move catering equipment for years and never thought about it as a security gap. The advance team had it locked down and posted within an hour.
The stuff nobody thinks about unless they're paid to think about it.
Third, chemical and biological threats. This is where it gets deeply technical. The advance team examines HVIC systems, where the air intakes are located, whether someone could introduce an aerosolized agent into the building's airflow. They test water supplies, they look at food preparation areas and supply chains. And fourth, electronic surveillance. They sweep for listening devices, for signals that might indicate an IED with a radio trigger, for any unusual electronic emissions in the area.
They're doing this with actual hardware, not just a flashlight and intuition.
The technical security division deploys with equipment that would make an electrical engineer jealous. The FIDO X3 explosive trace detector is a handheld device that can detect picogram level traces of explosives. A picogram is 1/1,000,000,000th of a gram. You could have residue on a doorknob from someone who handled explosives 3 handshakes ago, and this thing will flag it. They also deploy TSCM kits, tactical surveillance countermeasures, which are essentially portable spectrum analyzers that sweep for radio frequencies, infrared signals, acoustic leaks, you name it.
3 handshakes ago is a very unsettling unit of measurement, but it raises a question. How do you avoid false positives with something that sensitive? If I shook hands with someone who shook hands with someone who was at a construction site where blasting was happening, am I suddenly a person of interest?
That's a legitimate operational challenge. The detectors are calibrated to specific chemical signatures associated with military and commercial explosives, RDX, PETN, TNT, Semtex, things like that. Construction blasting agents like ANFO have a different signature, and the device can distinguish them. But you're right that sensitivity creates a signal-to-noise problem. The advance team doesn't treat every positive hit as an imminent threat. They treat it as a data point that requires resolution. They'll run the test again, expand the search area, try to identify the source. It's investigative, not reactive.
It's not a bomb detector in the Hollywood sense. Beep, run. It's a forensic tool.
And it's not just the hardware sweep. The advance team is also establishing what they call the sterile zone. Every room is divided into concentric security rings. The innermost ring, where the Protectee physically stands or sits, that gets the most intense scrutiny. Explosives detection, listening device sweeps, chemical agent testing. The protocol requires that any room where the Protectee will spend more than 15 minutes be swept for CBRN threats, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear. That's a formal requirement, not a suggestion.
the 15-minute rule. So if the president is just walking through a hallway, that's one standard. If he's sitting down for a meeting, suddenly the room needs to be cleared for nuclear threats. What's the logic behind that threshold? Why, 15 minutes.
It's a risk calculation based on exposure time and attacker planning cycles. A hallway transit takes seconds. An adversary would need to know exactly when the protectee would pass through and have a device timed perfectly. A 30-minute meeting gives an adversary time to execute a more complex attack, and it gives any dispersed agent, chemical or biological, time to accumulate to a dangerous concentration. The 15-minute threshold is the point at which the service has determined that a static exposure becomes tactically significant. Below that, the protective detail's mobility and the compressed timeline make a complex attack much harder to pull off.
That threshold drives a lot of the logistics. It's why advanced teams care so much about the schedule. They need to know exactly which rooms the protectee will occupy, and for how long, because the sweep requirements change. A 30-minute bilateral meeting in the Oval Office is a very different security problem than a 90-second walk across a tarmac.
The scheduling team sometimes pushes back on this, because they want flexibility. The protectee might decide to linger somewhere, or a meeting might run long. The advance team has to plan for the maximum plausible duration, not the scheduled one. If there's any chance the protectee will be in that room for more than 15 minutes, it gets the full CBRN sweep, regardless of what the schedule says.
Let's talk about the coordination side, because they're not doing this alone. They're working with local law enforcement, fire departments, EMS.
That's a massive part of the job. The advance team doesn't just survey the physical space. They're building a security infrastructure from scratch in a city they may never have visited before. They coordinate with local police to establish perimeters and traffic control points. They work with fire departments to identify hazards and pre-position equipment. They coordinate with EMS to map emergency evacuation routes and identify the nearest trauma-capable hospitals. And they vet local personnel, hotel staff, venue employees, anyone who will have access to secure areas. Background checks, credentialing, the works.
The hotel bartender suddenly has a federal background check. I want to pause on that because it seems almost absurd on its face. The president is probably not ordering a drink from the hotel bar. Why does the bartender need to be vetted?
Because the bartender has access. They're moving through the hotel's back-of-house areas. They know the service corridors, the kitchen, the loading dock. They might have keys or key cards that open doors the advance team hasn't secured yet. And perhaps more importantly, they're a known face to other staff. If someone shows up claiming to be a bartender but isn't on the vetted list, that's an immediate flag. The vetting isn't just about the individual. It's about establishing a baseline of who belongs, so that anyone who doesn't belong stands out instantly.
It's not just a background check on a person. It's building a known population baseline for the entire venue.
For foreign travel, the coordination gets exponentially more complicated. The advance team has to work with host nation security services, which means navigating language barriers, different operational protocols, different legal frameworks for use of force. The 2023 advance for President Biden's trip to Kyiv is a case study in how extreme this can get. That was a multi-week operation involving dummy motorcades to confuse surveillance, satellite imagery analysis of the route, and deep coordination with Ukrainian intelligence. The advance team was essentially operating in an active war zone.
The 2019 Trump visit to the DMZ. That was a small team landing at Panmunjom 48 hours ahead, coordinating with North Korean security, which is about as unusual a bilateral advance as you can imagine.
You're literally coordinating with a hostile nation's security apparatus to protect the American president. The trust dynamics there are, every piece of information you share could be exploited. Every piece you withhold could create a security gap. It's an incredibly delicate dance. I've heard that in situations like that, the advance team operates on a need-to-share basis rather than need-to-know. The host nation gets exactly enough information to do their part of the job and not one detail more. The motorcade route, yes. The timing of specific movements, maybe not. The location of the counter-assault team?
We've covered the physical sweep, the technical surveillance countermeasures, the coordination with locals. But there's another layer here that I think people miss, the human factor. The advance team isn't just looking at buildings. They're looking at people.
This is where it gets into protective intelligence, and it's arguably the most sophisticated part of the operation. The advanced team reviews intelligence reports on known threats in the area. They analyze social media for protest planning, for attack planning, for any chatter that suggests someone is paying the wrong kind of attention to the protectee's visit. They assess the protectee's exposure to crowds. A rope line event versus a closed-door meeting require completely different threat models.
They're doing this in real time, as the trip is being planned. But how does that actually work in practice? Are they scrolling Twitter looking for threats?
There's an entire protective intelligence and assessment division that supports this. They have analysts who do nothing but monitor open source intelligence, social media, forums, dark web chatter, for threat indicators related to upcoming trips. The advanced team gets a threat briefing before they even deploy, but once they're on the ground, the counter-surveillance units take over the human observation piece. These are plainclothes agents who blend into the crowd and watch for anyone conducting hostile reconnaissance. They're looking for behavioral patterns. Someone who's paying too much attention to security positions rather than the event itself. Someone photographing infrastructure rather than the protectee. Someone who seems to be timing response intervals or noting patrol patterns.
The left-of-bang approach, identifying pre-attack indicators rather than waiting for the attack itself.
And it's not just instinct. These agents are trained in behavioral analysis, in pattern recognition, in the specific indicators that precede different types of attacks. Someone preparing a vehicle-borne IED behaves differently than someone planning a lone actor shooting. The advanced team's counter-surveillance units are trained to spot both. A vehicle-borne IED planner might be seen doing dry runs of the route, timing traffic lights, checking security checkpoint response. A lone actor might be more focused on the venue itself, testing doors, noting camera positions, showing up at the site multiple times with no apparent purpose.
The counter-surveillance team is essentially hunting for hunters.
That's exactly what they're doing, and the best ones develop an almost intuitive sense for it. They'll tell you that something felt wrong about a person, and when you press them, they can break it down into a dozen specific behavioral indicators they process subconsciously. It's pattern matching at a level that's hard to teach and even harder to replicate with technology.
Now, there's another piece of this I want to get into. The logistics. Medical pre-positioning, communications, vehicles. It's not just about threats. It's about being ready for anything.
The medical side is huge and often overlooked. The advanced team coordinates with the White House Medical Unit to identify trauma-capable hospitals along every route and near every venue. They pre-position blood supplies that match the protectee's blood type. They establish secure communication links between the medical team traveling with the protectee and the local hospitals that would receive them in an emergency. They also arrange for armored vehicles to be staged at multiple points along the route, secure phones with encrypted channels, and emergency evacuation aircraft on standby.
The blood supply detail is one of those things that sounds like spy fiction, but is completely real and completely practical. If the president is shot, you don't want to be calling ahead to the hospital asking if they have enough O negative on hand. You want it already there, already cross-matched, already in the refrigerator with a label on it.
It's not just the president's blood type. The advanced team coordinates blood supplies for the entire protective detail and senior staff traveling with the protectee. If there's an attack, multiple people might need transfusions simultaneously, and you can't have the local hospital's entire blood bank depleted by the first two casualties.
If something goes wrong, the response isn't figure it out. It's execute the plan we wrote 3 weeks ago.
That plan accounts for multiple contingencies. What if the primary hospital is inaccessible? What if the motorcade route is blocked? What if communications go down? Every single one of these scenarios has a pre-coordinated response. That's what the advanced team is really doing. They're building a decision tree for every possible failure mode, so that if something happens, the protective detail isn't making it up on the fly. They're executing a pre-scripted branch of a plan that was designed weeks earlier.
This brings us to something I find genuinely fascinating, the cold hit problem. When the protectee makes an unplanned stop, a spontaneous decision to visit a diner or a school or a factory, the advanced team has minutes, not days. How does that work?
This is where the system gets stress tested. A cold hit is exactly what it sounds like. The protectee decides to stop somewhere that wasn't on the schedule, and the advanced team has to assess and secure it in real time. No prior survey, no pre-coordination with local law enforcement, no background checks on the staff. It's the most dangerous scenario in protective operations.
Because you've lost the one thing the entire system is built on. Preparation.
And the way they manage this is through what's called warm sites. These are pre-vetted locations that have already been surveyed on previous trips or during routine area familiarization. Every city the president visits regularly has a list of warm sites, hospitals, hotels, restaurants, schools, that have been assessed and can be activated quickly. When a cold hit happens, the advance team immediately checks whether any warm sites are nearby. If so, they can pull up the existing security assessment and execute a compressed version of the standard sweep.
It's like having a library of pre-written security plans you can grab off the shelf. But what happens when there's no warm site nearby? When the president points at a random diner in a town he's never visited and says, "Let's get pie."
Then you're running what's essentially a flash site survey. The advance team splits into immediate action roles. One agent clears the interior, not the full CBRN sweep, but a rapid visual and explosive trace check of the area the protectee will occupy. Another establishes a perimeter outside, coordinating with the shift agents to control access. A third is running the staff through an on-the-spot identity check, driver's licenses, quick database queries. Counter-surveillance agents are already positioning themselves in the crowd, watching for anyone who reacts to the motorcade's unexpected stop. It's chaotic, it's compressed, and it's absolutely not ideal. But they train for it constantly. The cold hit is the scenario that separates the truly exceptional advance agents from the merely competent ones.
I imagine the post-advance debrief is where a lot of the institutional knowledge gets built. After the protectee leaves, the team files a report on what worked, what didn't, any anomalies they observed.
That's a critical part of the process that never makes it into the public narrative. After every trip, the advance team files a detailed after-action report. What were the vulnerabilities they didn't anticipate? What local resources were particularly helpful or unhelpful? What new tactics did they observe from potential adversaries? All of that feeds into the agency's institutional knowledge base and shapes future advances. It's how the Secret Service gets better over time, by treating every operation as a learning opportunity.
I've heard that some of these after-action reports have actually changed the way the service thinks about specific venues, or even entire categories of threat. Like, a single observation from one advance agent about a novel surveillance technique can end up in the training curriculum within a year.
There's a famous example from the early 2000s where an advance agent noticed someone using a then-novel infrared camera to try to detect heat signatures through hotel windows, essentially trying to determine which rooms were occupied by the protective detail based on equipment heat. That observation got written up, circulated, and within 18 months the service had incorporated IR countermeasures into the standard advance protocol. One agent's sharp eye changed the entire playbook.
Let's talk about a concrete example that illustrates the complexity here. The 2024 advance for a presidential visit to wildfire-affected areas in California? That's a scenario where the normal playbook doesn't work.
Because the environment itself is a threat. You're dealing with active fire perimeters that can shift unpredictably. Air quality hazards that affect both the protectee and the security detail. Disrupted infrastructure. Roads that may be closed or compromised, power lines down, communication towers damaged. The advance team had to coordinate with CAL FIRE, with the National Guard, with local emergency operations centers, all while building a security envelope in an environment that was actively changing.
The motorcade routes. You can't just plan a normal route when half the roads might be closed or on fire.
You need multiple redundant routes, and you need real-time intelligence on which ones are viable. That means embedding someone with the fire command center, getting live updates on fire behavior and wind patterns. It's advanced work layered on top of disaster response, and the two don't always play nicely together. Disaster response is about flexibility and improvisation. Protective security is about control and predictability. Reconciling those two is extraordinarily difficult. You've got a fire chief who needs to be able to redirect resources instantly based on fire behavior, and a Secret Service agent who needs the motorcade route to remain fixed so the countersniper positions remain valid. Those two imperatives are in direct tension.
Another example. The 2022 advance for Vice President Harris's trip to the Munich Security Conference. That's a multinational coordination nightmare.
You've got German Federal Police, Bavarian State Police, hotel security teams, the conference's own private security, plus the Secret Service advance team and the Vice President's protective detail. every single one of those organizations has its own protocols, its own chain of command, its own rules of engagement. The advance team's job is to weave all of that into a single coherent security plan, and they have to do it while respecting German sovereignty and German law.
Which means the Secret Service can't just dictate terms. They have to negotiate.
And that's a skill set that doesn't show up in any training manual, diplomatic negotiation under time pressure. The advance agent is part security expert, part logistician, part diplomat. They're building relationships with foreign law enforcement in real time, often in a language they don't speak fluently, while the clock is ticking down to the protectee's arrival. I've heard stories of advance agents learning enough technical security vocabulary in a new language in 2 weeks to be able to coordinate room sweeps with a foreign team. That's not in the job description, but it's what the job demands.
Let's step back and talk about what all of this means for people who aren't protecting presidents. What can a normal security professional or event planner actually take away from the Secret Service's advanced methodology?
There are three principles that translate directly. First, pre-survey every venue. Not just the main room, every room, every hallway, every loading dock, every rooftop access point. You can't secure what you haven't seen. Second, establish concentric security rings. The innermost zone gets the most scrutiny. Outer zones get progressively broader but less intensive checks. This lets you allocate resources efficiently rather than trying to secure everything at the same level. Third, pre-coordinate with local emergency services. Know which hospital you're going to. Know how you're getting there. Know who you're calling. Don't wait until something goes wrong to figure out the response.
The warm site concept is also directly applicable to corporate executive protection. If you've got a CEO who travels regularly to the same 5 cities, you should have pre-vetted safe locations in each one. Hotels you've already surveyed, restaurants you've already assessed, hospitals you've already coordinated with.
It's the same principle, just scaled down. And here's the thing, even without any resources at all, even as an individual, you can apply the advanced team mindset to your own personal security. Before you go somewhere unfamiliar, scout it. Look at photos online, check the layout, identify the emergency exits. When you walk into a restaurant or a theater, note the exits. Note who's paying attention to you. Note what feels off. Most people walk through the world on autopilot. The advanced team mindset is about turning that off and actually seeing your environment.
It's the neighbor interview principle. The single highest yield intelligence gathering technique is just paying attention to what's around you. I love that you mentioned looking at photos online before visiting somewhere, because that's something anyone can do with zero training. Pull up the street view of the restaurant you're meeting a client at. Where are the entrances? Where's the parking? What's the neighborhood like? 5 minutes of virtual scouting can give you a mental map that most people won't have.
Almost nobody does it. They'll spend 20 minutes reading Yelp reviews about the appetizers, but 0 minutes looking at the floor plan. It's a complete blind spot in how most people navigate the world.
Let's talk about where this is going. The threat landscape is evolving. Drones, chemical attacks, cyber-enabled surveillance. How are advanced teams adapting?
The Secret Service is already experimenting with drone detection systems. A commercial drone with a payload is a serious threat, and traditional perimeter security doesn't address it. They're also investing in AI-powered threat analysis. Using machine learning to scan social media and other open-source intelligence for indicators that a threat is developing. The challenge is that the volume of data is enormous, and the signal-to-noise ratio is terrible. AI helps filter the noise.
The line between advance work and real-time intelligence is blurring. The advance team used to do their survey, write their plan, and hand it off. Now they're increasingly feeding live data into the protective detail during the event itself. Social media monitoring, drone detection feeds, real-time traffic, and weather updates.
The advance is becoming a continuous process rather than a discrete phase. And that's probably where the future is heading. Protective intelligence that starts weeks before the event and continues through the event itself, with no hard boundary between planning and execution. It's more resource intensive, but it's also more effective. And I think we're going to see the role of the advance agent evolve into something closer to a real-time intelligence officer who happens to be embedded with the protective detail, rather than someone who does a survey and then moves on to the next site.
To come back to what Daniel was asking, what is an advanced team searching for, and how far ahead do they travel? They're searching for everything. Line-of-sight vulnerabilities, structural weaknesses, chemical and biological threats, electronic surveillance, human threats in the crowd, medical and logistical gaps. And they're doing it anywhere from 48 hours to 30 days ahead, depending on the complexity of the trip. It's not just walking through a room and checking for bombs. It's building an entire security architecture from the ground up, in a city they may never have seen before, under time pressure that would break most people.
They do it over 8,000 times a year. It's one of those government functions that, when it works perfectly, is completely invisible. You only notice the advance team when they fail. And the fact that we almost never notice them is the highest compliment they could receive.
If you're planning a high-profile event, start your advance today, not the day before. The difference between a good security plan and a great one is how long it's been marinating. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, Moriori scribes on the Chatham Islands produced a genealogical manuscript known as the Rokohu Bark Cloth Codex, whose distinctive blue-black ink was derived from fermented sap of the Hana tree mixed with ash from burned bull kelp, a dye source found nowhere else in Polynesian manuscript tradition.
I don't know what to do with that. Fermented tree sap and kelp ash. And this produced a blue-black ink? That's actually chemically interesting. Most plant-based inks fade to brown over time, but the ash would add carbon, which is incredibly stable.
Fermented sap and kelp ash. Of course there are. Hilbert just gave us an ink chemistry lesson and didn't even realize it. This has been my Weird Prompts, produced by the very patient Hilbert Flemingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or search for us on Spotify. If you enjoyed this one, leave us a review. It helps more than you'd think. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.